Welcome back, everyone, to Spoonful of Sugar. The following episode is about anesthetic agents. It's written by Tanya Mulherker. This is a highly detailed episode providing generous amounts of information for both Step 1 and Step 2 listeners. Let's have her introduce herself and take it away.
Hey, future doctors. Thanks for tuning in to Spoonful of Sugar, a podcast made for medical students by medical students to help the medicine go down. My name is Tanya Mulherker. I'm a student at Drexel University College of Medicine, and I will be your host today. Imagine you are in the operating room setting up a patient for surgery. The patient is successfully put under anesthesia. As you help the surgery team reposition the patient, you notice the alarms beeping, indicating a blood pressure of 75 over 42 and a heart rate of 105. What medication would you give to help increase the patient's blood pressure back to normal range? In this episode, we will review common anesthetic agents, their properties, usage, and side effects. During this episode, I will be asking a lot of questions, so I encourage you to think about the answers and pause along the way if needed. Let's jump right into it. What are some classes of anesthesia? I'll give you a hint. I'm thinking of three broad classes. All right, so there's general anesthesia, monitored anesthesia care, also known as sedation, and regional anesthesia. What does it mean to be under general anesthesia? The American Society of Anesthesiologists defines general anesthesia as a drug-induced loss of consciousness during which patients are not arousable even by painful stimulation. And this often coincides with impaired ventilatory and cardiovascular function as well. What does it mean to be under monitored anesthesia care, specifically deep sedation? Monitored anesthesia care, also called MAC, is anesthesia in which a patient cannot be easily aroused, but will respond purposefully to painful stimulation. So, just to review, what is the major difference between general anesthesia and deep sedation? The major difference is that under general anesthesia, patients will not respond to painful stimuli, whereas in sedation, they would respond purposefully. What is regional anesthesia? Regional anesthesia involves injection of local anesthetic to block sensory stimuli and potentially motor function as well. What are the two broad types of regional anesthesia? So I'm thinking of peripheral nerve blocks and then central or neuraxial anesthesia, which includes spinals, epidurals, and paravertebral blocks. I wanted to help you categorize the different types of anesthesia, but we will not be focusing on regional anesthesia for the rest of this episode. So switching gears, when putting a patient under general anesthesia, what three main things do you want to achieve? I'll give you a hint. They all start with A's. So the three main things you want to achieve with anesthesia are anesthesia, analgesia, or pain control, and amnesia. There's also a mnemonic that says the six A's of anesthesia, which would include the first three, as well as areflexia, autonomic areflexia, and anxiolysis. Let's start at the beginning of a hypothetical case. At the very beginning of the case, you anticipate rolling the patient back to the OR, helping them move onto the bed, and then starting the setup by hooking them up to monitors, possibly getting an additional IV or arterial access while they might still be awake. In order to make the patient more comfortable, what kind of medication might you want to start off with? An anxiolytic would be helpful. Most patients receive midazolam, also called Versed. What class of medication is midazolam, and what kind of receptor does it bind to? Midazolam is a benzodiazepine. Remember, those typically end in PAM or LAM suffixes. It binds to the GABA-A receptor and acts as an agonist. Midazolam acts as an anxiolytic and does have some properties of helping with anterograde amnesia as well. Those are kind of the main things I wanted you to know about midazolam. But just for some extra information, I'm going to review some other things as well. So midazolam is typically avoided in elderly patients. Everybody has a different cutoff, but I think the general one is you don't really give it to patients over 65 because it does have that risk of increased post-op delirium. It can also cause significant respiratory depression when it's combined with opioids. How do you reverse the effects of midazolam in the case of overdose? Flumazenil. Remember that this can induce seizure activity in some patients, so you do have to be careful. In most cases, midazolam is used at smaller doses, so this isn't a major concern, but something to keep in the back of your mind. All right, I think I've asked you a lot about midazolam, so let's get back to our case. Some of the access, like arterial lines and even extra IVs, can be very painful for patients who are awake. What medication could you give to help with pain management? Typically, fentanyl is given for analgesia. What receptor does fentanyl act at? So fentanyl is a mu opioid receptor agonist, and it has very short-term effects, so you can use it for post-op pain as well. Now imagine that you have all the monitors and access set up, and you are ready to start general anesthesia. What medications could you use for anesthesia induction? So there are both inhalation anesthetics and IV anesthetics. Typically, the IV anesthetics are used for anesthesia induction, so let's talk about those first. What are some examples of IV anesthetics that are used for anesthesia induction? The most commonly used ones are propofol, etomidate, and ketamine. Other IV anesthetics include dexatomidine, which is also called Presidex. So propofol is the most commonly used IV anesthetic that I've seen. So let's talk about that first. What receptor does propofol act at? It acts at the GABA-A receptor as an agonist. It has a very fast onset and offset. And what are some side effects that you can think of that propofol might cause? Some general side effects that it can cause are myocardial depression, decreased systemic vascular resistance, so the blood pressure can drop really quickly, burns on injection, and some people give lidocaine right before to decrease the pain of injection of propofol. Next, let's talk about etomidate. What receptor does etomidate act at? Etomidate is also a GABA-A agonist. It also has a fast onset and offset. So what are some side effects of etomidate? Generally, it can cause post-op nausea and vomiting. It can cause adrenal suppression, and it can also cause myoclonus. What receptor does ketamine act at? So ketamine is the unique one. It is an NMDA antagonist. What are some side effects of ketamine? So ketamine is the one that can cause dissociative anesthesia. It causes catecholamine release, so that can result in tachycardia, increased intracranial pressure and intraocular pressure, and it can also cause increased airway secretions. What receptor does dexmedetomidine act at? So Presidex is a selective alpha-2 agonist. And what are some side effects of this? It can cause bradycardia and hypotension. How does Presidex affect breathing? It actually has minimal respiratory depression, so it's good for mimicking natural sleep. And this is good for those monitored anesthesia care cases or the sedation cases, because in those cases, you don't want to intubate the patient or paralyze them, so they can kind of just breathe on their own, and it's almost like they're sleeping for the whole case. Another IV medication given is remifentanil. So what receptor does remifentanil act at? I'll give you a hint. It's probably what you're thinking the medication name sounds like or has in its name. Just like fentanyl, it is a mu opioid receptor agonist. What can it be reversed by? It can also be reversed by naloxone. I just wanted to talk about remifentanil in this episode because I saw it used in a lot of cool cases on my anesthesia rotation to help with pain control. So it is so good at pain control throughout a case that it prevents a patient from moving. And this is really useful in cases where the patients are not supposed to be paralyzed for neuromonitoring purposes. So in some neurosurgery and ENT cases, they're working very close to nerves and areas where they don't accidentally want to hit them. So they'll have a neuromonitoring tech in the room who is actively tracking the sensory and motor stimuli responses, and that's why you can't paralyze the patient during the case. So again, remifentanil in these cases is really useful for keeping the patient very still. So those are the main IV anesthetic agents. So we talked about propofol, etomidate, ketamine, dexamethasone, and remifentanil. So before going into detail about the inhalation agents, it's really important to understand the concept of minimum alveolar concentration, also abbreviated as MAC, not to be confused with monitored anesthesia care. So again, that's minimum alveolar concentration. What does 1 mAC of gas mean? 1 mAC of gas is defined as the concentration of inhalation agent that is needed to prevent movement in response to painful surgical stimulation in 50% of patients as measured by the end tidal concentration. So that's a fancy way of saying the concentration of inhalation anesthetic that is needed to keep approximately half of the patients still in response to painful surgical stimuli. And MAC with volatile agents is additive. That means if you're using multiple volatile anesthetic agents, you can add their MAC values for the total MAC. There are some factors in a patient that do affect the MAC. So some factors can increase MAC, some can decrease MAC, and this essentially alters the potency of the drug. So factors that increase MAC decrease the potency of the drug. It's kind of an inverse relationship. But that makes sense because if you're increasing the minimum alveolar concentration, that means you require more of the drug to achieve the desired effect. Whereas if you're decreasing the MAC, you decrease that concentration and you need less of the drug. So what are some factors that increase MAC, meaning you need more drug to achieve the desired effect? Some of these factors include infancy, a bunch of hypers, so hyperthermia, hyperthyroidism, hypernatremia, catecholamines, and then chronic opioid and chronic alcohol use. On the other hand, what are some factors that decrease MAC? Factors that decrease MAC include increased age, pregnancy, hypotension, hypothermia, sedatives, acute opioid use, acute alcohol intake, and lithium. I don't anticipate you'll be tested on these as a medical student, but it's important to keep in mind that increased age and pregnancy specifically are in that decreased MAC category, and thus those patients do end up requiring less of a drug to achieve the desired effect. All right, so what are some examples of inhaled anesthetic agents? halogenated agents like isoflurane, sevoflurane, and desflurane, and also nitrous oxide. Do you know, out of the examples that I just gave you, which category is the most common agent used for maintenance of anesthesia in the U.S.? So halogenated agents are actually the most common agents used for maintenance of anesthesia in the U.S., and what receptor do they primarily act on? Halogenated agents also act on the GABA-A receptor as an agonist. Halogenated agents do have some side effects. So how do they affect the blood pressure? Halogenated agents actually cause dose-dependent vasodilation, which results in an overall decreased systemic vascular resistance. So what does that do to the blood pressure? Right, that would drop the blood pressure. How do the halogenated agents affect myocardial function? They can actually cause myocardial depression. And how are they eliminated? They're actually ventilated without significant metabolism, which is a good thing because they stay pretty much isolated to the lungs, and most of them do act as bronchodilators. All right, the next side effect that I'm going to ask you about, you might have seen it a lot in your reading, but it is the one thing that halogenated agents specifically, as well as other medications that we'll get to, do have an increased risk of triggering. It's okay if you don't know where I'm going with this, but I'm actually hinting at the fact that all halogenated agents can trigger malignant hyperthermia, which is incredibly dangerous, and we'll talk about it in a bit. And you might see this in your reading, but in terms of the halogenated agents, your options are sevoflurane, isoflurane, and desflurane mainly. And out of those three, which is the most expensive and most irritating to the airway that can precipitate bronchospasm? This would be desflurane. So it's not used as much. I haven't actually seen it used at all. I mainly see iso and sevo used. And just generally, isoflurane is cheap and it can be used for maintenance, but it has the slowest offset and onset, and it is mildly irritating to the airway. Sevo, which is the one I've seen used most often, has a faster offset and onset than isoflurane, and it can be used for inhalation induction as well. Nitrous oxide is mainly used as an adjunct for anesthesia, induction, and emergence, so it's mainly used as like the beginning of the case and the very end of the case, and it allows for a decreased concentration of the halogenated agents. So some people like to use it for a little bit of a smoother and quicker wake up because you can really like turn down the halogenated agents towards the end of the case. I know that we briefly talked about the side effects of the different anesthetic agents, but I did want to simplify it for you and do a little bit of a recap. So, what effect do most anesthetic agents have on blood pressure? Most of the ones that we talked about result in hypotension. So remember that propofol is the most widely used intravenous anesthetic, and that causes a direct drop in the systemic vascular resistance. And we also just talked about the halogenated agents that also drop the SVR. So this really just works to drop the blood pressure in total. Let's go back to the case we discussed at the very beginning. So, just a reminder, we have started anesthesia induction, and the patient's blood pressure is now 75 over 42, and a heart rate of 105. What medication would you want to give to help increase the patient's blood pressure back to normal range? So, as we've been discussing, a lot of the anesthetic medications do come with undesired side effects, and unfortunately, the main way of countering these side effects is with other medications. What class of medications do you imagine we use for countering this drop in blood pressure? So, mainly adrenergic agonists. And what are some examples of adrenergic agonists? There's phenylephrine, ephedrine, epinephrine, and norepinephrine, otherwise known as levofed. What receptor does phenylephrine act at? Phenylephrine primarily acts at the alpha-1 receptor. And what is the primary effect it has? So if you remember all the way back to M1, alpha-1 receptors are located primarily on vascular smooth muscle. So agonism of these receptors would primarily cause vasoconstriction, which results in increased peripheral vascular resistance and thus increased arterial blood pressure, as well as increased left ventricular afterload. So phenylephrine, again, primarily acts at the alpha-1 receptor. The other adrenergic agonists, like ephedrine, epinephrine, and norepinephrine, are all non-selective adrenergic agonists. Now imagine you're waking up your patient from anesthesia, and suddenly their heart rate spikes to the 120s. What medications would you consider giving? In this case, we would want to use adrenergic antagonists, so mainly beta blockers, because we're specifically tackling that high heart rate. Do you know which beta blockers we could give? We could give esmolol and labetalol. So esmolol is what type of beta blocker? It's a selective beta-1 antagonist, and it's very short-acting due to rapid redistribution and hydrolysis by the RBC esterases, and its half-life is about 9 minutes. What about labetalol? What receptors does it act at? Labetalol is actually a non-selective beta and alpha-1 antagonist, so it has greater effects on blood pressure than esmolol due to the alpha-1 effects it has. So whenever your patient is both tachycardic and hypertensive, labetalol would be a better option. All right, so I'm going to bring it back to what are the goals of anesthesia? Again, this is the 6 A's that we talked about. So we already talked about anesthesia, analgesia, amnesia, and anxiolysis. What's left? Next, we're going to talk about areflexia and movement inhibition. So what types of medication do you use to help with this? Paralytics. Good. What are the two types of paralytics? So there's depolarizing and non-depolarizing. What's an example of a depolarizing paralytic agent? This would be succinylcholine. And how does it work? It binds to the acetylcholine receptors in the post-junctional membrane, and it maintains ions in the open position, thus preventing repolarization of that membrane. And what electrolyte disturbance do you worry about the most when you're using succinylcholine? You worry about hyperkalemia. So what kinds of patients do you want to avoid use of succinylcholine in? I'll give you a hint. This is kind of important for emergency medicine and trauma. So you want to avoid succinylcholine use in patients you worry about hyperkalemia in. So that would be burn patients, crush injury patients, and then those who have prolonged immobilization. So you don't want to forget about your elderly patients who might be bedbound. What is another big side effect of succinylcholine? Succinylcholine can also be a trigger for malignant hyperthermia. So remember, the other medication we talked about being a trigger for malignant hyperthermia is the halogenated agents. And what medication can you give to reverse the effects of succinylcholine? All right, that was a trick question. There's actually no medication for reversal, and you basically just have to watch until the medication wears off. It takes about a few minutes. I know that sounds pretty scary, but in ECT therapy, the treatment is very short. So they just give succinylcholine at the beginning. You ventilate the patient for a bit, let them have a seizure, and then they basically just spontaneously start breathing pretty quickly. So how do the non-depolarizing paralytic agents work? Where do they bind? So they are actually competitive agonists to the acetylcholine receptors in the post-junctional membrane. So they will outcompete the acetylcholine binding to the receptor. What are some examples of non-depolarizing agents? So this would be rocuronium, vecuronium, and sesagicarium. So they mainly have curonium and curium endings. So the medications with a curonium ending, how are they metabolized? So they primarily have biliary, hepatic, and renal components to metabolism and excretion. What about cisatricurium? This is a little bit different. How is it eliminated? So cisatricurium actually spontaneously breaks down via Hoffman elimination. So this is a good medication to give in patients with renal failure. What medications would be helpful with reversal of the non-depolarizing paralytic agents? Again, these are the competitive acetylcholine antagonists. So you could use acetylcholine esterase inhibitors or anything really that will increase acetylcholine at the membrane. This essentially blocks the breakdown of acetylcholine at the neuromuscular junction. It increases the ratio of acetylcholine to outcompete the antagonist. What's the most common acetylcholine esterase inhibitor that's used? Neostigmine is the most commonly used because it does not cross the blood-brain barrier. And what issues arise with acetylcholine esterase inhibitor use? It doesn't just act at the neuromuscular junction, it acts systemically, so you have to worry about some cholinergic side effects. And how do you combat this? You would give an anticholinergic agent in conjunction, so most commonly glycopyrrolate is used, and again, this does not cross the blood-brain barrier as well. There's also a newer drug on the block that can be used to reverse the non-depolarizing paralytic agents. You might have seen this used in practice. So this medication is called Sigamidex. It can be used on the paralytic agents that end in curonium. So basically, it works by encapsulating the rocuronium and vecuronium molecules, and it prevents them from acting on the acetylcholine receptors. It works really quickly. It only takes a few minutes. The only downside is that it can be expensive. Now let's talk about a brand new patient scenario. Imagine you induce anesthesia using IV anesthetics, and then you turn on some volatile agents to maintain anesthesia for the case. Within 1 hour of starting general anesthesia, you start to notice that your patient's heart rate and skin temperature are going up. You might even notice an irregular rhythm on the monitor. The oxygen saturation starts dropping, and you check the patient's limbs and notice they're very stiff and heavy and difficult to move. What are you worried about, and what do you want to do about it? This is really dangerous. This sounds like it could be a case of malignant hyperthermia. Some of the main symptoms of malignant hyperthermia include severe muscle rigidity or spasms, rapid shallow breathing, and problems with low oxygen and high carbon dioxide, a rapid heart rate, irregular heart rhythm, dangerously high body temperatures, and excessive sweating. They can also have some patchy or irregular skin color that is basically mottled skin. What causes malignant hyperthermia? So some people do have a genetic predisposition to susceptibility, and most often the malignant hyperthermia sensitivity is related to an autonomic dominant mutation in the RYR1 gene, which codes for the ryanodine receptor. What does the ryanodine receptor normally do? So the ryanodine receptor normally sits in the membrane of the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and it's responsible for the release of calcium from the intracellular stores during excitation-contraction coupling in both cardiac and skeletal muscle. In patients who are susceptible to malignant hyperthermia, the ryanodine receptor is abnormal and it remains open, causing a buildup of calcium in the skeletal muscle. So calcium basically just keeps pouring out into the muscle, and this causes a massive metabolic reaction upon exposure to triggering agents. What's the treatment for malignant hyperthermia? You definitely want to stop any medications that could be triggering the MH, and you want to administer dantrolene. Other things that might help include hyperventilation, oxygen supplementation, cooling the body, extra fluids, and just general supportive care. All right, folks, that's all the new content I wanted to cover in today's episode. And now we're going to do a rapid review. So I'm just going to go through, ask some rapid fire questions, and do your best to answer. What's the main difference between general anesthesia and deep sedation? The main difference is that in general anesthesia, the patients would not respond to painful stimuli, whereas in deep sedation, they would respond purposefully. What are the main goals of anesthesia? So the three main things you want are anesthesia, analgesia, and amnesia. And if you extend it to the 6 A's mnemonic, you also want areflexia, autonomic areflexia, and anxiolysis. Midazolam is the most commonly given anxiolytic, and remember it's a benzodiazepine, which means it's a GABA-A receptor agonist. What is the medication that's commonly given for analgesia at the beginning of a case, and what receptor does it act at? So we talked about fentanyl being given at the beginning of a case for analgesia, and it is a mu opioid receptor agonist. What are the most commonly used IV anesthetics for anesthesia induction? This includes propofol, etomidate, and ketamine. Other IV anesthetics include dexamethasone, also called Presidex. What receptor do most anesthesia agents act at? Most of them actually act at the GABA-A receptor as an agonist. This includes propofol and etomidate, which are IV anesthetics, as well as the inhaled halogenated agents, which would be sevoflurane, isoflurane, and desflurane. What medication is associated with dissociative anesthesia? This would be ketamine, which is an IV anesthetic agent. What receptor does ketamine act at? It acts at the NMDA receptor as an antagonist. What receptor does dexamethasone act at? It acts as a selective alpha-2 agonist. What does 1 mAq of gas mean? A mAq of gas is defined as the concentration of inhalation agent needed to prevent movement in response to painful surgical stimulation in about 50% of patients, measured by end-tidal concentration. What are some factors that increase mAq? This would be infancy, hyperthermia, hyperthyroidism, hypernatremia, catecholamines, chronic opioid, and chronic alcohol intake. What are some factors that decrease mAq? This would be increased age and pregnancy mainly, as well as hypotension, hypothermia, sedatives, acute opioid and acute alcohol use, as well as lithium. What is the main effect of most anesthetic agents on the blood pressure, and what are some medications we can give to counteract this? Most of the anesthetic medications cause hypotension through direct drop in systemic vascular resistance, and we can give adrenergic agonists to counteract this. Some of which we talked about are phenylephrine, ephedrine, epinephrine, and norepinephrine. When waking patients up from anesthesia, they often get tachycardic. So what medications can you give to counteract this? You can give beta blockers like Esmolol, which is a selective beta-1 antagonist, which is pretty short-acting. And another option is labetalol, which is non-selective beta and alpha-1 antagonist, and it has greater effects on blood pressure, so it's also helpful to use this in cases that have hypertension as well. What kind of paralytic agent is succinylcholine, and how can it be reversed? Succinylcholine is a depolarizing paralytic agent, so it binds to the acetylcholine receptors, preventing repolarization of the membrane, and it cannot be reversed, actually. You just watch until the medication wears off. What kind of paralytic agents are rocuronium, vecuronium, and sisatricurium? These ones are the non-depolarizing paralytic agents, and they act as competitive antagonists to the acetylcholine receptor. How do you reverse them? You can reverse them either by outcompeting the medication with increasing acetylcholine at the membrane with acetylcholinesterase inhibitors. The main one you would give is neostigmine. Or you could use Sugammadex, which would encapsulate the medication and prevent it from acting on the acetylcholine receptor. What are some symptoms of malignant hyperthermia? This would be severe muscle rigidity, rapid shallow breathing and problems with oxygenation, a rapid heart rate, maybe an irregular heart rhythm, high body temperature, and excess sweating. What receptor do patients who have a susceptibility to malignant hyperthermia have an issue with? They have an issue with the ryanodine receptor. What is the treatment for malignant hyperthermia? So you want to stop any medications that could be triggering the malignant hyperthermia, and some of those triggers we talked about are succinylcholine as well as the halogenated inhalation agents, and you want to administer dantrolene as well as take other supportive measures. And that brings us to the end of the episode. Thank you for listening. If you found this episode helpful, please subscribe to our podcast. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, visit our website at spoonfulofsugar.org and post them under the link for this episode. Good luck with studying, and remember that if you ever have an SOS moment, Spoonful of Sugar is always here to help the medicine go down.